This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Since the day it passed, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, has been the clearest and biggest target of Republicans in Washington. The way Donald Trump was talking, Obamacare was going to be history the Monday after inauguration. But as we've seen, a repeal or replacement of Obamacare is much, much harder to do than to talk about. An oncologist and health policy expert named Ezekiel Emanuel, everybody calls him Zeke, was one of the architects of the ACA. He helped the Obama administration figure out just how to expand health care without exactly blowing up the national budget. And with the ACA on the chopping block, Emanuel is trying to influence what the Republicans can come up with to replace it. In this climate, it's almost impossible to have a cool-headed conversation about health care. But Emanuel insists we've got to try, and he's had closed-door meetings with the Trump administration. I spoke with Zeke Emanuel early last week as the Senate was poised to release a revised health care bill. Now, if I'm not mistaken, you met with President Trump about—
Three times.
So what were those conversations like?
Those conversations were quite good. The last time I met with him was the end of March, just before the Paul Ryan pulled the bill because he didn't have the votes. And I basically told him it was a terrible bill and would leave many people uninsured. It didn't address cost control. It was undermining of the market.
Does he have a grasp of the details?
He asked appropriate questions. In the room was not just him. It was Price and Ryan and Pence and Mulvaney.
So congressional leaders.
Yes. And we had a very thorough discussion, I would say, of the bill.
You're being diplomatic.
Yes. I mean, it's for the president to reveal the details if he wants to. I would just say—
But why be diplomatic?
I'm not for this bill. So yeah. I'll tell you why I think I want to be diplomatic. I'm not for this bill. I've made it clear to everyone, and I've said it on many media outlets, this bill is cruel, throwing 22 million people off insurance, creating uncertainty so that premiums go up.
This is the original Senate bill you're referring to.
Correct. Eliminating the expansion on Medicaid, forcing the states to cover more of Medicaid, thereby denying them resources to put into other things like education, highways, infrastructure, I think is not a way forward in
America. Do you have the view, as many Democrats do, that this bill is all about a setup to create a tax cut down the line for the wealthy?
Well, actually, this bill is a tax cut for the wealthy. Forget down the line. You don't need down the line. You're getting rid of taxes where the rich have to pay an added 2.9% on their Medicare bill and other taxes that they need to pay to support universal coverage. You know, and I think the data are that, you know, someone like Warren Buffett makes, you know, millions of dollars if the Republican health care reform goes away and poor people have to pay a lot more. That is totally cruel. That is totally backwards.
But when you're in the room with them, when you're in the room with Paul Ryan and other congressional leaders who are for such bills, they obviously don't see the bill that way or don't reveal themselves to see the bill that way. What is their logic?
I can't tell you.
You're totally bewitched by it.
There isn't a logic that is focused on health care. That's quite clear.
It's a logic focused
on something besides health care. This bill does not advance healthcare in this country. That's quite clear. There's no positive step, no positive step in this bill, minus two. It keeps young people age 26 on their parents' plan, Who benefits from that? Well, largely upper-middle class kids. You know, I was giving a lecture at Yale in a class on healthcare. There were about, I don't know, 120, 130 kids in the class. I said, how many of you are still on your parents' health insurance plan? 95% of the hands went up, right? So the parents of kids at Yale are benefiting, right? And then it does lower the ability to get subsidies down to 0% of the poverty line. Now it's 100% of the poverty line. So the people who are caught in the so-called Medicaid gap, that is, a state hasn't expanded Medicaid, but they can't get subsidies to buy insurance in the exchanges, they now can get some subsidies. Those are the two positives in this bill.
And that's it.
That's it. Everything else in this bill totally undermines health care and the health care system that we've built.
Is there a medical system, a medical slash economic system that exists in the world that you look at, you know, piningly, you if only that were ours?
I'm going to talk out of two sides of my mouth now, okay? So first of all, I don't like that question. The political scientists have this notion of path dependence. You once you go down one path, you've got all these institutional structures, legal structure, administrative things. We can't go out and say, oh, you know, Sweden, it's the best. We're just going to take it and plop it down in the United States. On the other hand, I am in the my next book is an international comparison of 12 different healthcare systems. So to see what we can learn from all of them. And interestingly, this book is not about how we pay for healthcare so much. I mean, it does have an element that paying is important. But this book is about how do we, at the coalface, how doctors interact with patients, how hospitals interact with patients, how nurses, and how can we change that? Because ultimately, our poor performance in the healthcare space, you know, we don't do so well on infant mortality. We don't do so well on maternal mortality. We don't do so well on a lot of metrics. How do we change that? And that's something to do with the payment, but much, much more to do with how doctors are actually structuring the delivery of care in the office and in the hospital and things like that.
Zeke, your book starts off with an extended, not anecdote, but story about an elderly woman named Miss Harris. Tell me a little bit about her.
So Miss Harris, when I saw her, was 95 years old. Now, she has very high and labile blood pressure. It goes up and down. As a result, she had some kidney problems. She also has heart failure. She was at her sister's house. It was a hot summer day, and she keeled over. Her sister, you know, calls 911. They take her to a nearby hospital. Doc in the emergency room determines she doesn't have a stroke, doesn't have a heart attack, but she has this rhythm thing called sick sinus syndrome, sends her to a affiliated hospital a little further down with a cardiac unit, and they put in a cardioverter, that is an implantable shock device, and a pacemaker, all in one device, into her heart. When you ask her about it, it's very unclear that she actually consented to this.
Is the system failing her in some way?
She's getting a lot of care that it's not clear she consents to. One of the things that the palliative care nurse did almost immediately is ask her, well, would you want to go on dialysis if your kidneys failed? No. Would you want to go into the intensive care unit if something disastrous happened? No. As she says very prominently, you know, I'm ready for God to take me. And by the way, going to the doctor is a big effort for her. The only time she leaves the house is to go to her kidney doctor, order one of her two cardiologists. And it was quite clear she was dreading the need to ask a neighbor to drive her to the doctor. This was not what she wanted.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I remember John Stewart once saying, he said, you know, he's talking to somebody who is very stoic about their health care and whatever. He said, look, I'm Jewish. I get gas and I go to a specialist. And yet you, Zeke, wrote an amazing article in The Atlantic some time ago saying that when you hit 75 and you're 59 now?
Correct.
You, any medication that you might be on, you're going to stop, whether it's a thing like a statin or something minor or even something serious. That's it. Why and what are you telling us?
So what I said is that any medication where the justification for taking that medicine is to prolong my life. Now, not every medicine is like that. Some medicines are to relieve pain. Some medicines are to relieve some other deprivation. My hearing's not perfect anymore. I survived three kids. How else could it, you know, you survive three kids unless your hearing's not perfect. So if I needed a hearing aid, I would do a hearing aid. Or if I needed some pain relief, I'd do pain relief. But I'm not trying to prolong my life after 75. And partly, I think lives have an arc.
But they've gotten longer.
Not necessarily better. You know, if you look at the curve, low levels of dementia until about, turns out 75, and then it shoots up. And at 85, it's, you know, between 33 and 50% of the population has dementia. And if you talk to the experts in Japan, everyone at 100, definitely demented. I think there are three components to a meaningful life. I'm not looking for happiness. I'm looking for meaningfulness and fulfillment. Meaningful work, meaningful relationships, and fun. It's quite clear if you look at the data, for almost all of us, meaningful work will go down, you know, by 75. Very few people after 75 are productive in their work. Okay, so then you're left with fun and meaningful relationships. Interestingly, both require pretty good cognitive function. And if you don't have that, then, you know, and I don't want to risk, you know, being deteriorated and being a big burden on my kids, I think that would be the worst situation. My just hanging on and being a burden on my kids just to have more years. That does not seem valuable to me. And a life where the dominant thing is only fun or play or, you know, doing crossword puzzles, watching TV, reading a few books, seeing the grandkids once every month or something, that's not a meaningful life. I don't want that life. I don't think anyone should find that life fulfilling.
I guarantee you, Zeke, when your article came out or people listening now, you can almost hear the voices saying, now, wait a minute. It's meaningful to me. I'm 82. I'm seeing my grandchildren on Tuesday. It's meaningful to me. You think that's deluded.
Well, I would challenge them if that really is meaningful or if what they have done is narrowed down what constitutes meaningfulness for them to accommodate their limitations, physical, cognitive, and whatever. And that's, I think, part of the big issue. I think it changes your idea if you know that, you know, at 75, it's really going to be, I don't know that it's going to be over, that I'm going to die, but it's going to be very different. My certainly ability to work and be productive that way is going to go down. And so I think you change how you approach the now and the living.
Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, his new book is Prescription for the Future. By the way, we checked back with Emanuel after the Senate released its most recent bill, and he said the revisions, as far as he's seen, don't really change his opinion at all.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.